This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome, listeners from around the world. Thank you so much for joining me. This is your host, Jason Hartman, with episode number 731. We are going to have the second half, sort of a Q&A session that I think you're going to get a lot of information out. This is a meaty, high-content Q&A session from one of our live events. We'll have that coming up in a few minutes. But first, I wanted to do a kind of a roundup, circling back with one of our prior investor case studies from several years ago. You might remember the young gentleman in his 20s who was on the show back maybe, I want to say about 5 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, I'm not sure. He was talking about how he had his own business and how he was buying rental properties in Indianapolis and then in Memphis after that. And over the years, he's had some definite bumps in the road. It hasn't always been easy, for sure, but he left me a nice Vox message about 2 weeks ago, and he said, you know what? I know I've complained now and then, but overall, I'm really happy because I just checked the value of my property on Zillow, and he was super happy. And that was Drew, and Drew is a new father, well, relatively new father. Since he was on the show last, he got married and had a kid, and he talked before about his warehouse in Laguna Beach, and that's where I am. I'm with him at his warehouse because he was kind enough to take in some boxes for me, and I'm picking them up out here after being in San Diego for a couple of days. And so we are in Laguna Beach, California. Drew, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it sure beats being 106 inland. It's still a little cooler here. Still a little cooler, but still pretty hot. So we're in the canyon right now, but yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
So what's been going on with you the past few years with your investments? I mean, your business has grown dramatically, so congratulations.
You've
got a great business.
Yeah, so I mostly sell stuff on Amazon. That business has kind of exploded for me.
And you sell printer cartridges. That's your main thing, right?
Yeah, so when I started, I kind of focused on customers that were small businesses and quickly learned that really where the money is and where the least amount of complaints are the people that have the deep wallets who buy larger cartridges that go in commercial machines and
commercial printers
that do banners and blueprints and that sort of thing. So I sort of focused more on that inventory, you know, than the $20 cartridges. So these cartridges might be $250 rather than $20. So I've kind of explored that, you know, built my website. So if you have a plotter, feel free to go to my website.
Oh God, I didn't know this was going to be self-promotional, but go for it. InkSafari.com.
Yeah, InkSafari.com. So InkSafari.com. And you know, it's a small business.
He's a shameless self-promoter here. We wanted to talk about your real estate investing.
But yeah, so my real estate investing was kind of interesting. I had bought four properties and in Indianapolis, and that kind of gave me the money to, well, here's what happened really. I'd saved a bunch of money to buy a house in California. And since I'm self-employed, once the economy fell out, I had probably about 50% of funds to put down on a house in California. And I found that since I'm self-employed and I'm really self-employed, I'm not, you know, stated income self-employed, that a lot of the issues I was having was, no, everyone laughed when they wanted to lend me money.
They don't want to let you qualify for loans. So your investments, actually, on the investment side, I mean, that's kind of what kept you from buying a house for a little while.
Yeah, and, you know, so I ended up buying a house. I bought a house in 2013, and we bought a house in Old Town Orange, which is a small area walking to the, you know, like the
Chapman University, the
yeah,
circle.
Yeah, it was like, you know, a bunch of antique shops and restaurants. It's a cute area, but we moved from Laguna Beach inland because...
You can't buy anything in
Laguna Beach. You know, if you want, you get Crap Shack for $1 million, and now they're about
$1.5 million.
Now they're about $2 million. Yeah, so we bought a house out there and actually did really well. Even I mean, we probably would.
But
have
that was the luck. That was speculation.
That was luck.
It didn't make sense. Talk to us about your investment properties.
Okay.
So those are the sensible cash flowing properties. Now here's one of the things I wanted to say about that. I just met one of our other clients who many of you have met. He's also my partner in a couple of properties we own together. Some large properties, a mobile home park and an apartment complex. And many of you met him. His name is Steve at some of our events, maybe at our Meet the Masters. He was at the one, not last year, but the year before last. And I pointed him out in the audience, and I know several of you listening may have talked to him. But here's one of the things he said, Drew, and I think this is kind of interesting. It goes in line with your story. He said that he was talking with a real estate expert who compared buying a property in San Jose, California, in 1986, okay, like before a lot of the Silicon Valley boom. I mean, certainly there was some of it going on back then. And then comparing it to buying a property in like St. Louis and some other of these linear markets and how much more money you would have made on that property. But I said, wait, Steve, are you really doing the math right? Because the Silicon Valley property in San Jose back in 1986, and listen, I remember 1986, and I remember, actually, I was dating, I had this gorgeous Canadian girlfriend from Vancouver, and I dropped her off because she came down to visit me in Southern California. We drove up the coast and went to San Francisco and stuff like that, and I dropped her off at the San Jose airport, and I remember, that's the last time I saw her. So I remember how I was feeling leaving that.
Long distance, short term.
Yeah, well, no, it wasn't that short term, it was about a year, but anyway, here we go on another tangent, right? Okay, back to real estate. But I remember consciously thinking of, you know, how San Jose was and the Silicon Valley market back then. And it's, you know, for a long time been a high flyer of markets, right? But even back then, your rent-to-value ratio was only 0.4% versus 1%. So, yes, you would have made a lot more money in appreciation on the San Jose property, but you would have been feeding it all these years, okay?
Right.
Because, you know, you would have received 0.6% less money in income every month for all those decades versus what you'd receive on a St. Louis property, for example, or a Chicagoland property or a Memphis property.
Yeah,
so
I think a lot of it comes down to timing. I think there were a longer period of opportunity possibly in these other markets that you recommend than maybe in California. Like, I'll give you a perfect example. When we lived in Laguna Beach, we were living in a fourplex that they bought in 2010 for $810,000.
You were renting it. You were
renting.
Yeah, okay.
And they had a fourplex for $810,000. They probably put, you know, $50,000 into fixing it up. So altogether, you know, let's say they were in there for $850,000. The house next door to me in Orange, that's a twoplex, sold last week basically for $830,000. Mm-hmm. So about the same amount of money.
Right.
So a fourplex at the beach versus a twoplex inland. So the price is, that same place in Laguna Beach is probably worth 2.5, and they bought it for 810. So,
but there's two things though. Nobody knew that was going to happen.
Right.
That was speculative. This is what I always say. Look, lots of people get lucky, and these high-end properties, they don't view them right. Their brain gets all cloudy and foggy and turns to mush because the property basically becomes, because the cash flow is so crappy, it becomes a forced savings program where
right.
they, for, you know, 10 years are supporting that property either by not getting the cash on cash return they should have received. You can't hear the dogs that don't bark.
Right.
Nobody looks at the profound impact of what didn't happen. And what didn't happen is they didn't have a self-supporting property or a cash flow positive property with good return on investment.
Yeah, I think
So that's what didn't happen. What they didn't notice, they had the forced savings program, and they think, oh God, the value went way up. But, you know, and that's great. And they got their windfall, but they've been supporting it for a long time in a forced savings program, which, in a way, look at, for undisciplined people, at the very least, some real estate is a forced saving program.
Right.
It's like, look, you don't have a choice. You have to contribute to Social Security. Now, we know that's a big Ponzi scheme, of course. But if it were a legitimate savings program, as it was designed to be originally, that's what sometimes your real estate can be, because it's not easy to pull the equity out and spend it like in a checking account.
Yeah, okay. I think there's a couple factors here. I mean, when I bought my properties in Indianapolis, you're looking at, you know, a house that I bought for $50,000 and I probably put $10,000 into it.
You're going to make everybody very jealous because you can't repeat that nowadays.
No.
Well, you can, but it would not be a property like what he got back then.
So I bought in these clustered neighborhoods where they were all built fairly, you know, at the 2005, 2006. And so they're all new builds. And
they were boom bust homes.
Boom bust homes. Yeah. So everyone that got in there bought at a bad time.
Yeah.
So there was, since most people put nothing down, there was an incentive to walk away because they had very little skin in the game. So since there was such a gluttony of inventory, you know, I sort of was able to buy something below the cost of construction. So I'm buying it. I'm probably getting close to like a 1.7 return on investment of the RV ratio.
Right.
Whereas like probably if I'd bought in Laguna Beach, my RV ratio would be 0.7 if I bought at the best time ever.
At the best time ever in Laguna Beach, it would have been 0.5 probably. Like,
yeah,
in other
words,
when the prices were the lowest, the most depressed, and the rents were the highest as a ratio.
Something like that. So, you know, and the thing is, I couldn't buy a house in Laguna Beach, and I couldn't get financing. So the ability of me being able to buy a house was how much money I had as cash in the bank. So I sort of was doing this thing every 6 months. I would just scrounge and save and do as best I could to
buy another one. And you buy a rental property with cash, because you couldn't be financing.
I bought a rental property with cash, and then the rent that I was getting from those rental properties paid for my rent in Laguna. So, you know, then I grew up and moved to a house and
and got married.
Married. So I think the one lesson that I learned along the way that I would just encourage people to do is that when you buy the property, make sure you have a buffer to add improvement value to the property when you purchase it. So I'll give you an example. A lot of these houses that I bought, they needed carpet replaced, and I hadn't saved up quite enough money to. The only thing I could do is just put in kind of the cheapest carpet you could get to get a renter.
Let me just interrupt you, because one of the things, we may actually have that on this segment, I can't remember, but one of the things, folks, and I talked to Steve about this at lunch, I want you to start bulletproofing your properties.
Yeah.
In the long run, it's going to be a lot less expensive. In the short run, it's going to cost only a little more.
Yeah. So
the example being vinyl plank floors throughout and eggshell or low sheen paint throughout.
Okay.
Small difference, but it can make those turns a lot less expensive.
And I don't think Jason, we haven't talked about this, so I'm this is not
say it on the air for the
first
time.
Yeah, this is not a coordinated effort, but I completely agree with Jason. I went and every single property, once the property management company said this carpet needs to be replaced, here's the bid here's the bid to replace $1 a square foot. It costs, you know, $1,500 to replace the vinyl, replace it with carpet. Yeah. I went with vinyl plank flooring.
Spend $2,500 into the vinyl plank flooring. Yeah.
You know, and it's
well worth it.
It might be more than that, but yeah, it's way worth it, because if it's two times or at the most three times of replacing carpet,
it's not anymore.
The thing is, you can buy vinyl plank flooring now for about the same amount as carpet.
A little more
because of the installation cost.
We did the comparison on the last show. Fernando and I were at on the Wednesday show, not the Flashback Friday, but Fernando and I were at a real estate expo, and the prices we got there were, you know, decent rental type carpet, $1.20 a square foot, vinyl plank, $2 a square foot. So it wasn't quite double.
And that's true. You can get the cheap stuff for $1, but I wouldn't recommend that. Spend $2, get the nice stuff so it doesn't, you know. And the thing that's nice about vinyl plank flooring, it has a residential warranty, usually lifetime. It's extremely simple to install. You could do it yourself, but you're probably not there. And what's also really nice about it is it's waterproof. So it can seamlessly go from the bathroom to the kitchen to the living room.
And just try and just do one flooring throughout your house. Don't have tile here and vinyl plank there, and just have it all the same. It looks much better. It doesn't cut the house up, and it's a lot simpler when you need to do a replacement and take the X-Acto knife and cut out one of those pieces of plank to put another one in.
Yeah, so I kind of systematically went through each one of my properties and replaced it and kind of upgraded as I went and added, you know, added value to the house and added, you know, what would be rental, a little bit more rental income to cover the gap because people, it has a nicer appeal inside. And so I call it, you call it, what did you call it? I call it baby proofing.
I call it bulletproofing.
Okay, yeah. Bulletproof and baby proofing. Yeah. So that's.
The tenants are babies, aren't they?
Yeah. And I think it's actually really helped in the rehab, in the rent ready bids. You know, so I recently got a rent ready bid and it was probably half of what it would have been if I had carpet. Yeah.
So the next time any of you have a make ready that you need to do, then, you know, just do get the eggshell paint in there, and that's the finish, not the color. That's just the finish. The good paint that you can wipe it off with 409 or Fantastic, and it's clean. It doesn't scuff up very easily or anything. And get the vinyl plank type floors and make your properties more bulletproof. So that's a good lesson. But Drew, we got to get to our segment. And it's funny because you said you didn't have anything to say, and it's been 16 minutes we've been talking, right? Okay, but here's what I wanted to tell people is I think one of the big lessons from your experience as an investor, I mean, you're excited about investing again now, but you had some years where you were getting pretty discouraged, where you were looking at it like this, and I remember talking to Katie, your wife, about it, where it's like you can make so much more money focusing on your business than screwing around with these little rental properties. You know, that was kind of the attitude for a while. But what you don't notice a lot of times, and this is the thing, investors, is what is kind of happening behind the scenes.
Yeah.
There is some real wealth being created for you there because the properties are like a big cruise ship. It goes very slowly. You know, the business is like an airplane if you've got a successful business, okay? And it's going from place to place really quickly. The cruise ship is just chugging away real slowly. It's only going 20 knots, but it gets there, you know?
Right.
I think that's the lesson I kind of wanted you to share.
Yeah, so there's obviously active income and passive income, if you want to call it that. And my
business, also bubble wrap.
Yes, yeah. So
sorry,
there's plenty of that here.
We are in Drew's warehouse.
But I kind of have changed my tune a little bit, and you know, you need to focus on both because, you know, one is going to pay the bills now and one will probably pay the bills later. That's kind of what I've focused on. And I am interested in investing in the future. And Jason always tells me not to time the market, but it seems quite frothy.
Well,
but it depends
that's
where.
That's only because you live in California.
Yeah,
okay? it feels frothy.
It's crazy. But I'm sort of waiting for where the smart money will go and trying to sort of see. I wish I bought some silver back when it was 14, but I know you're not a gold bug. But
precious metals.
It's at 20 now.
Yeah. Yeah, precious metals are overrated. But hey, silver was at $46.
That's true.
$47.
That's true.
And they all said then it was going to $75, but it never did.
Yeah. It's
don't be a speculator.
No.
Be a cash flow investor, folks. That's really the rule. And you know, I know you're trying to time the market, but I'm telling you, I've never seen a market timer win in the long run.
No, and honestly, the thing is I think I was pretty good at timing the market last time.
Oh, you were back then.
But
that's 2020. Hindsight is 2020.
No,
you look in the rearview mirror, and of course you made a fortune.
Yeah, so I think I timed the market pretty well. But here's to your point, is that my plan of buying a house in California at the bottom was I got blindsided by some unknown factor and I couldn't buy a house at the bottom. I wanted to, but I couldn't because they weren't lending any money out. So I kind of had to change my plan. So, you know, now I'm trying to figure out where to throw the dice now, and I don't know. What do you think?
Don't throw dice. Invest for cash flow. That's what I think. But here's one of the things you got to realize about that. You were trying to buy property when nobody was buying.
Right.
And you did that with some rental properties. You got what? You got 7 or 9 rentals ultimately?
Yeah, I have 8.
8, okay. Yeah. And then you've got your house in which you live. And the reason it's the bottom of the market, one of the reasons, is that the lending just contracts dramatically.
Right.
And the amount of available financing, it just evaporates from the market. The banks got very conservative, obviously. They were very scared to lend. And people were very scared to buy. So that's what goes on in a contraction. And we got to wrap this up. But did you have one final comment there? Because we got to get to our segment, actually. We always go too long. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to never announce that we're going to have a guest or a segment. And I'm just going to go on and start talking. And if I shut up soon enough, we'll play the segment. But that's what I got to do.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know if I have any other thoughts for you, but I'm interested in keeping my eyes open. I had a friend send me a property in Little Rock that looked beautiful.
Little Rock's pretty great. The most landlord friendly market in the country.
Yeah, that was interesting. That perked me up. You know, I was looking.
Wait, was that your friend Aaron?
Yes. Yeah, Aaron Copelson, and I was looking at.
He was at our last event.
And I was looking at some properties in Indianapolis again, and I kind of was actually going to put an offer in on a place recently, and come to find out it was in a bad area. So I kind of, and there was a place in Memphis I was looking at. So I'm still kind of keeping the pulse on things, but I'm waiting for the next downturn, whenever that may be.
Yeah, don't try and time the market, I'm telling you. There it probably is another shoe to drop, folks. I have said that many times. The economy is pretty weird. There's a lot of crazy stuff going on out there. But remember, our philosophy, if you're following it, and I hope you are, is linear markets, which will be far less affected by whatever happens in the economy.
Yeah.
They'll be affected, but far less.
And I think they're not as
volatile.
You know, and the other thing, too, is like we bought in a time that's completely irrational the other way. You know, it was completely crazy. Everyone was, you know, jumping out of the ship. So I think some of the deals now are, you know, if you look at these houses, I can't believe you can buy a house for $100,000
and rent it for $1,000 a month.
Yeah, that's pretty good, you know. One other thing, and I'll just kind of leave it at this, is I think it's really important that when you look at an area that you're going to invest in, I think, you know, Jason has kind of come around to this, that you buy I buy in 4-packs. So like if I buy in an area, I'll try to get in a crew a couple of them, so I just don't get diversified to in non-existence. Like I want to buy in packages, so
you want to have a little chunk here, a chunk
there.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, I called a property management company recently because I was having a problem getting a hold of somebody, and I said, hey, I have 4 properties with you guys. If I don't get a call back today, I'm going to start looking for another property management company.
So you have some leverage.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah.
So, you know, and then I got a call from the owner, and he explained that, you know, I didn't get your call at 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and I'm sorry, and, you know, we worked it out. It was fine, but
you have some leverage.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I freely admitted is that one of the mistakes I made is I over diversified.
Yeah.
So 3 to 5 markets, at least 3 ultimately, no more than 5. And it, of course, depends how big your portfolio is. So let's, Drew, we got to get to our Q&A. Okay, one more. He has one more comment.
No,
I can tell.
Well, yeah. Well, kind of in wrap up is that I'm sort of trying to find where the next places that people want to be. So where do people want to live? I say, like, does this city have cancer, or is it in the infancy?
Is it blighted, or is it a place that's attractive?
Yeah. Does this place have cancer, or is it in its infancy? And so I'm trying to find, you know, the next Austin, the next Portland, the next Seattle, try to see where the money's going to go. And so I think that's kind of what I'm going to look into.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. All right. Well, hey, our panel, let's finish that. This is actually the Q&A portion, and I think you'll find this to be very interesting. You may actually hear Drew's friend Aaron on this because I think he had some of the questions that you're going to hear here in a moment. And let's just jump to that. And in the meantime, check out jasonhartman.com for our properties and some of the areas. Little Rock is on there that Drew mentioned, Indianapolis, of course, and Memphis, where he owns properties. We will look forward to talking with you on the next show. We also are about to make an announcement. It's not too far away. Now, Drew's climbing up his shelves here to get boxes. That's funny. Bye, Drew. We will be announcing our Meet the Masters event pretty soon here, so stay tuned for that announcement. Let's get to the rest of our panel session and the all-important Q&A. Any questions? Yes, name and city.
Laura Drury, Union City, Michigan. I just wonder about finding tenants when you're self-managing, because when we were at Meet the Masters, it sounded crazy to self-manage, but this short time later, it's sounding like maybe we could do it now. Because we've learned a lot from our managers, for sure.
Let me tell you one self-management pitfall. I don't want to forget to say this, okay? And then we'll have them answer the question. Is be careful, you know, when that property is vacant, number one, insurance will make this difficult for you. Because some insurance companies will not give you insurance, or at least not give you reasonably priced insurance, if you don't have a manager. Okay? And they also limit the amount of time they will insure a vacant property unless you pay a fortune. So if it's vacant for a long time, it can start getting costly.
I had to educate an insurance company just the other day.
You had to educate an insurance company.
Yeah.
Well,
I could manage properties across the country.
Yeah.
And right. You want to get me going? You know, I just, okay, here are all the different companies and the business. I gave them like 100 things that they probably didn't care about. But they were wondering the same thing. You know, is this for real? You're living somewhere and the properties are somewhere else.
You
know, we're not sure
that.
About this.
Yeah.
But, you know, people will catch up. You know, it's, what was your original question, though? He said
tenants.
Tenants.
Sure. There are many, many ways that you can actually find tenants without having a property management company. For one, you can actually hire a property management company. You actually hire 2, 3, 4, 5.
A la carte.
Exactly. Just for that. Yeah. You just tell them up front, I'm not looking for property management service. I need to find a tenant. They may be a little more inclined to actually provide tenants to some of the properties that they currently have. But for example, like James, they turned down 100 potential renters last month. You know, they definitely have a need. So, you know, they would charge you probably a bit of a higher lease-up fee than what they would charge their actual clients, but that's one way. Another way is, you know, you can actually post, you know, there's obviously Craigslist, and you can put yourself on Zillow and whatnot. And I think through Cozy Now, they actually have a plugin where you can where you can actually post your property and have it on some of the different outlets they have available. That's obviously an extra feature, an added cost, but those are definitely some of the ways.
AppFolio works similarly. The one that I'm using for the Atlanta properties, they have a feature where you can syndicate. They make it easy for you to create a web page with the property for marketing purposes, and then you syndicate that through all of the rentals.com and Zillow and all.
It's basically like it creates a little website for you on your property.
Right.
Oh, one other thing about that is make sure you have good photos of your property. Okay? And this is probably going to happen. The best opportunity is when you buy it. Okay? So get a set of good photos. Make sure they're properly labeled in your computer so you can find them. And I think it is well worth hiring a real estate photographer to take photos for you, because they'll come with a wide angle lens, and you need a set of really good photos of each of your properties. That's super important.
There's a company called zinspector.com. Jason, you probably know about these guys.
Uh-huh. I've heard of them. Yeah.
That's what they do.
Okay. Yeah. What? How much does it cost?
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Do your tenants have your phone number?
Jeff from Scottsdale.
Do your tenants have your phone number, or do you create a separate phone number just for the property management side?
Do for the Austin tenants, they have an email address. I just created a Google email address with the name of my company, and they'll send email through that. We also created, there's a company called Grasshopper, and Grasshopper is a company that allows you to create your own phone number, and you can then give that phone number to the tenants, and then through the website you can have all of these options on what happens when somebody calls that number, messages or forward to your phone or whatever. So I have both.
So here's one of the things I want you to think of too. One of the things Fernando could do with that is he could set up an email address for maybe all the properties in one geographical area. And if he had a relationship, and he probably does, with like a handyman in that area, or a TaskRabbit person, or someone who's just a like an assistant that you pay, just pay for play, that email could go to you and to that person, like Austin, you know, Fernando's Austin Properties at gmail.com, right? And that address could go to multiple people, right? Voxer could be another great tool for this too.
Yeah.
So lots of ways you can distribute the communications. And guess what? They're free. These are free tools, a lot of them. Grasshopper, yeah, I think, charges a nominal fee.
Yeah, it's $10-$15 a month. You can have like five different extensions. So you can actually have the same phone number and five different properties.
Yeah, four different states. Press one for Indianapolis properties. Press two for Quad Cities. You know, if you need service for your Quad Cities property, press two, you know.
Exactly. Boom. And if ever you do add your tenants onto Voxer, they can actually do so with just using your email address. You don't actually have to give them your phone number. FYI.
To answer your question directly, no, I don't give out my phone. I hate getting calls.
Kevin from Indianapolis, just one quick question about the assistant side of things. Have you hired that person? And if so, what did you look for? Who did you look for? And was that person experienced at all? Or is that something that you'll be looking for? What kind of things would you be looking for?
So the assistant that I hired in Atlanta had property management experience. And he is an accountant. He's an older person. He was with a financial, it's kind of a special case is what I'm going to get at. He knows how to deal with tenants. He thinks like a landlord. So it's kind of the right person to handle high stress situations. But the decisions are mine at the end of the day. He just pre-filters a lot of stuff. And as I mentioned in the beginning of the talk, when he brings up an issue, he already thinks of, you know, solutions to it. And it's not just a dispatcher. So that makes a huge difference.
Kelly from?
Washington, D.C. So I actually have several questions, so I'm going to hog the mic for a second. How do you handle move-out inspections when the tenant leaves?
So the last house we had a move-out inspection on, what the assistant did, is there's a company called Vineyards.com, which I think we've mentioned that before in Meet the Masters, and they specialize in make-readies, getting property ready for the next move-out. So they coordinated with the tenant a time for them to go to the property and inspect the property. And part of their services is to provide a list of repairs that are needed. So that becomes our move-out inspection. And then you can fill, we have forms that you can pull from the web for move-out forms, and then those forms can be sent to the tenant later on with whatever deductions are present.
And Fernando, Vineyards, we discovered them at the Note conference at Noteworthy, right?
CG.
It's CG. Genius, okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Good. Yeah.
Just to elaborate a bit on Vineyards, they provide a fantastic service. Some of you may be thinking, you know, how do I get a make ready done? How do I turn the property over? How do I get it painted and everything else? Vineyards is a fantastic company. They actually do all of that for you, whether it be ripping out floors, doing full paint jobs, if you want to put a new roof on, if needed, they'll actually do the whole thing for you. Just bear in mind that if you do use an a la carte service like that, you will be paying a bit of a premium. It's pretty obvious, but just get ready for that.
So, I don't remember how much I paid, sorry. They're expanding fast. But that's one option. I use Angie's List quite a bit. Angie's List, you know, works well in many markets. They have specials all the time, and you can hire a plumber for $200, and they'll go and take care of whatever that issue is. Sometimes those work really well. It also gives you a chance to filter out some providers, some contractors that don't do a good job.
And the importance of using a company like Angie's List is that they come somewhat pre-qualified. There's reviews on theirs and everything else, and oftentimes they have specials. But the biggest factor with that is if you were to just find someone off Craigslist or off some website and you don't really know who they are, and you provide them with the lockbox info, everything else, they can easily go in there, steal all your appliances, everything, because they know the property's vacant, and then just head off and you never hear about them again. So just be careful.
Amazon is also getting into that service provider business. If you search for a particular appliance, you know, they'll suggest
and they'll do the whole thing in installer. So if you need a new ceiling fan, you can buy the ceiling fan on Amazon and get it installed. But I was super excited about that idea, but the prices are too high. You know, like
for now.
Yeah. Hopefully it'll really start to become competitive. Yeah.
Okay, second question. There are so many legal aspects to management. How do you handle things like evictions or giving 24-hour notice for a contractor to get access and all of these aspects of you know, legal things that are going to management?
I haven't had any, interesting talking about self-management, that I haven't had any horror stories. There's no wood here.
There's what?
On my self-management properties. So I haven't had to choose what to do. But Jason just interviewed an eviction, nationwide eviction expert that can handle part of that process. That would be one option. But if I had to do it, I would proceed the same way with everything else. I would just search for companies that specialize in that particular part and hire them a la carte for that particular job.
Half of the time, we don't know how empowered we are and how many resources are out there. It's amazing. A lot of the time, the property manager, all they do is call an eviction service. You can call them direct. They'd be happy to have your business. That's why I did that podcast about it. So, you know, some property managers actually go to court and do the evictions themselves, but a lot of them just outsource it. You can just do it yourself.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean... The eviction notices and things like that are certainly one part of it, but I was thinking of like, okay, the plumber's coming in tomorrow and you have to give tenants 24 hours notice.
Give them notice.
Post on the door kind of thing. I don't know if that's...
Well, I don't think there's a requirement to post it on the door.
No.
Is there? Maybe there is. And so it might depend where.
Yeah,
we just sold
a property in Phoenix, and the amount of notice, you know, official, formal, received, verified notice that we had to give to tenants just in the process of selling it was crazy. Yeah.
But you can do that by email, can't you?
If they confirm that they've received the email, yeah. But if the tenant's not, you know, checking, then you have a problem. Okay, do you ever worry about veil-lifting suits? If the tenants have information about you personally?
In other words, piercing the veil of if you have an entity like an LLC, that's what you mean, right?
That's what I mean.
Veil-lifting suits, lawsuits. So that shouldn't matter legally if you're managing your entity, right?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm aware of it, but I don't think I treat it any differently because it's self-managed versus not. You know, we have liability insurance. I mean, that's kind of the first level of protection. And the LLC is set up for asset protection, and I do the best job I can with, you know, keeping accounts separate and, you know, not giving any ammunition for any potential lawsuit. And that's the best I can do, I think, for now, without going to extremes and, you know, complicating things.
Anything else?
One last question. Do you find that you're managing enough that you qualify for the real estate professional material participation time?
I do, but I'm not. I decided that for 2014, it didn't make sense for me to become a professional. I didn't have enough losses. In order for you to capture the benefits of real estate professional, you need to have losses.
Passive losses,
depreciation
losses.
In your real estate business.
And not real losses.
Passive losses.
Yeah.
So the answer is yes, I do qualify. I have enough. I qualify from a legal perspective, but it's not to my advantage. At least it wasn't in 2014. I'm doing 2015 taxes in the next month or so, and preliminary discussions with the CPA didn't seem like that would be also helpful. And as time goes by, at least given my current situation, as the rents keep going up and depreciation stays steady, I'm not going to see losses from that perspective unless I have lots of repairs and that sort of thing. But if things just go as they have been in the data that I've shown, the tendencies for me to have increasing incomes steadily, which again goes against capturing the benefits of being a real estate professional. So, you know, right now I'm not going to be checking that box in the tax return.
Last question over here.
Larry from Tempe.
Awesome.
And Oliver, you'd mentioned in vetting your property managers, asking the questions, what is the one question that I should definitely be asking?
That's almost like asking a potential mate. What's the one question, the one thing I should know about you?
Is there one question you standardly ask every single, or I mean, I'm not sure how many property managers you interview.
What I would definitely ask, it's not just the one question, I'd ask a slew of questions, but amongst one of the most important ones is, how do you vet your tenants? And what kind of questions do you ask them? What's the criteria that the property management company has to actually bring tenants into some of your homes? That's one of the most important factors. Some tenants, I mean, some companies only look at like the 3X factor. So does the rent, is the rent at least, you know, a third of the overall gross income that they bring in every month? If so, if yes, then, you know, they get that check mark and they allow the tenant to potentially rent your home. Whereas other property management companies will actually draft up a budget with the tenant. And that's more of a specialized service and only a few companies really do that. But if anything, that provides a heck of a lot better property management, in my opinion, because then you actually get a qualified tenant that knows exactly where their accounting is, where their budgeting is, and they know what they can really afford. And if they can't afford the specific property that they're looking for, that property management company will actually give them something else that they can.
And that's kind of a service that is more likely to happen in the lower end C-class properties, where they're going to do that budgeting thing, you know.
Actually, one of our providers, James actually does that for all of them, ABC. And mm-hmm. that's included. It's not a service added, but some of their property management companies probably do that as a bonus thing.
Good stuff.
So one thing that I would just add to that, it's a question, but you have to answer that yourself by looking at the property manager and the contract and so on. You really want to know that they are aligned with your interests. It goes back to what Jason said before. If they're going to make money when you do make money, then it's to their best interest to do the best job they can. So if they have a lot of fees that have to do with that are easy for them to abuse without you making any money off of that, then that's a red flag.
Thank you so much. That was just a wealth of information.